We good with that? All right. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 23rd, 2015, and we're going to start off by opening up a public hearing on House Bill 5011 related to the Construction Contractors Board. Why don't you folks come on up? And what do we need to know?
House Bill 5011 is the agency budget bill for the Construction Contractors Board. For the 2015-17 governor's request budget, the agency has requested other funds limitation in the amount of $14,540,074, 62 positions and 62 FTE. And then we have Jim Deneau before us here today from the Construction Contractors Board.
Perfect. Welcome, Jim. So here's what I'm going to share with you. I'm understanding that good things are going on, and so I want to get through this really quick today. All right? So okay. I'm hoping we can be done in 30 to 45 minutes.
I will be as brief as I possibly can, Mr.
All right.
Chair.
All right. So let's. I'm going to turn this over to you, and you just run with it.
Yes, sir. All well, right. For the record, my name is Jim Deneau. I am the Administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. It is an honor to be addressing you today about our agency's budget. I was hired as the result of a leadership shakeup about 6, 8, 10 months ago, and I've been on the job a little over 6 months now. And it's our goal to affect some pretty substantial changes in the agency over the course of this biennium. So I'd like to give a really, really brief who we are, what we do, how we're funded, and then get right into the challenges facing us and our strategy to meet them. So the board was founded in 1971 to regulate residential contractors. In 1990, the name was changed to the Construction Contractors Board, and a regulatory authority expanded to include commercial contractors. Basically, what we do is develop licensing standards and license contractors and enforce the construction contractor laws. We have responsibility to educate the public about licensing requirements, and we also mediate disputes between homeowners and licensed residential contractors. Our funding, thanks, Dustin, by the way, for doing that. The lion's share of our funding comes from licensing fees, nearly 80%. We also have a substantial amount that comes from the education program nowadays. Civil penalties make up about 9%. Most of that is transferred then to the general fund. This is our budget ask for this biennium, $14.5 million. It's a reduction from last time. And our ending fund balance, we're projecting just under 4 months.
Representative, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, could he say that again? Did he just say a reduction?
It is a reduction, and I'll describe the reasons why here in a little more detail.
Follow-up. So. Is that a first for any of the, not you, but anybody that's come here?
We're going to continue.
Mr. Sorry. Chair, Representative Hurd, if it's a first, well, I don't mind being the first. So this chart shows you, gives a kind of a visual description of the challenge that we face. It's no secret to anyone by this time that the construction industry was hit pretty hard in the recession. So we lost a lot of licensees, 20% or so. And over the course of the recession, those that stayed in business had to adapt. They had to find ways to work more efficiently, be more competitive. And the reason why we're not asking for more money and for fee increases is that we feel like we need to do the same thing. We need to get more efficient. We need to do the same work with more efficient and strategically placed resources. So that's our intent over this biennium. Even though our resources have declined, our mission does not. In fact, you can see here on this screen that we license numerous other categories of contractors now. In fact, in the current session that's in progress, there are two more groups that are being contemplated for licensure by the CCB, restoration contractors and road flagging companies. Enforcement is a continual challenge for any licensing regulatory agency. One of the criticisms that all such agencies as ours is subject to is you don't do enough enforcement. The fact is, you know, we do quite a lot of enforcement, and I'll say a little bit more about that in the future, but that's a continual challenge for us. And actually, in a down economy, you find more unlicensed activity, so it's really a more of a challenge. We have taken on at the CCB more responsibility in the area of education.
Let's go back to that previous slide real
quick.
Yes,
sir.
On the paid under the table, I'm assuming you're finding that out primarily by a phone call. Someone's calling at some point in time, or does that, how do you get that information?
That's one way we get it, Mr. Chair. Also, an investigator goes to a job site, checks a contractor's license. He's licensed as exempt. In other words, not supposed to have employees, but there are employees on the job.
Got it.
So we find it out that way as well.
Do you ever have communication with the Department of Revenue in terms of any type of connection back and forth there?
We absolutely do, yes, Mr. Chair. We are part of the Intercompliance Network, which you may or may not be familiar with. It's a group of agencies that share enforcement information. Revenue's part of that, CCB, employment, workers' comp.
Excellent.
So our investigators share enforcement case information.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in regards to the unlicensed folks, as far as how you find them out, is it the under-the-table payment, or is it more of either another contractor turned them in, or there's a dispute between the homeowner, in most cases, and the unlicensed contractor? What's the ratio there?
I don't know, Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd. I don't know what the ratio is, but there's a variety of ways that we find it out. Mm-hmm. People can submit information about unlicensed activity by the phone or by email. Very often it's just our investigators going out through the neighborhoods and finding them. I've ridden along with an investigator before, and it's really fascinating. These guys almost have a nose for where the construction activity is going on, so they're pretty savvy at finding those job sites.
And so just following up on that, and then we'll move on. Sure. So if that situation occurs and you folks go through your process, your penalty process, that information then is forwarded on to the Department of Revenue?
Yes, it is.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Chair, yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Deno, 2 years ago, you and I have had some of this conversation together separately, but 2 years ago during the CCB hearings, we learned that one of the examples of an unlicensed contractor was a locksmith who was in solo practice in Seaside, I think, I want to say, some coastal town in his late 60s, early 70s, had been this for a while, was unlicensed in part because of literacy issues, right? And in part because it turns out that even a locksmith at that time had to have exactly the same continuing education, had to take exactly the same exam as a large general contractor, which didn't make a whole lot of, heck of a lot of sense. This committee, working with Mr. Smith, then director of the agency, we came up with some, we allowed them to put in legislation to change the rules for locksmiths and home inspectors and encourage them to keep going. Do you have any sense of what percentage, that was a long preamble to the following question, any sense of what percentage of those unlicensed contractors might fall into that category of small, very specific trades that asking them to have to follow the same overall standards that a large general contractor has might not be a reasonable or business-friendly expectation? Mm. Where do we stand with that issue at this point?
I think that's Madam Chair, I think that's a fairly small percentage. Most
okay.
of what we find are construction jobs,
then that's
remodeling
not okay.
jobs, and so forth. Yeah,
that's not okay. That fine. If you think that's a fairly small percentage, and I do hope that the agency is continuing to think about these small categories. And I know you and I have had a conversation. You may be coming up with it more later, but about the fact that people often have to get licenses from multiple different boards to do one
right.
kind of job, and you may be addressing that later.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Hurd.
Sorry, I have lots of questions today. So, Mr. Director, in your experience at the CCB, have you seen a marked benefit to the continual education classes? Is it costing the CCB money to administer that situation?
co-chairs, Representative Hurd. I'm a little new to have a really good sense about that. I can say this, the continuing education program as it was rolled out has not functioned particularly well. And so we are working on that, meeting with stakeholders and folks that have had trouble with the system to find a way forward, to come up with something that's both meaningful and that is not onerous for the licensee.
Perfect. Continue.
Okay, so we can pass over education to online services. This is a challenge for us, offering online services. It is, I believe, incumbent upon state agencies, just like businesses in this world, to be able to offer services online, licensing applications and renewals, signing up for courses, filing complaints or notices of unlicensed activity. And given the current state of our IT infrastructure at CCB, we are very limited in what we can offer. I'll have a little bit more to say about that later. So that's kind of the world as it looks to us today, and I want to talk now about our strategy on how to meet some of those challenges that we're facing. When the leadership changed a while back, our board kind of took a step back and said, you know, we really need to refocus our attention on our core mission, appropriate licensing standards, doing a better job at enforcement, ramping up our outreach and public education, doing more to collaborate with other agencies and be transparent about our operations, and a customer service focus across all levels of the agency. So that was kind of the marching orders for the agency from the board. So one of my directions to staff is simply, in order to implement that strategy and that mission that the board gave us, don't reinvent the wheel. So there are lots of ways that our agency has had a habit of reinventing wheels. But there's a lot of good work that's been done out there that we can avail ourselves of without having to do it in-house. For example, national license testing standards. So if there's a testing standard available that is appropriate for Oregon, we intend to use it rather than develop it and maintain it ourselves. It's very labor-intensive, specialized, and expensive to develop and maintain valid exams. In fact, we are right now in the process of transitioning to a national exam for home inspectors. Also, in the area of education, we don't need to do all that ourselves. There are good resources out there. We're developing a really great partnership with the small business development centers around the state to offer courses for contractors. Also, the National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies, otherwise known as NASCLA, is a national association that we have been a member of for a long time, and they have all sorts of resources available that we really have not made a lot of use of. So they have contractor education resources. They develop contractor reference manuals for states. Currently, we develop our own. They also have numerous publications for public education, how to avoid getting scammed, how to hire a reputable contractor, and things like that. So we're going to avail ourselves of more of these resources as we move forward.
I want to compliment you on utilizing the small business development centers. They're near and dear to me, but they're just a tremendous resource, and I think it's good government, so thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, yes, they really are, and they're just so ready to help us and actually kind of help mentor us in developing a meaningful education program. So,
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'm so pleased so far with your leadership, having morphed from screaming at CCB in these hearings to now trying to find ways to help you all. I am very interested in the consumer information piece. I think so many people, and I would include myself in this number, are woefully ignorant in making contracts with folks to do various services, only to find out later that they were absent bonding or absent the requisite training. And I don't know what tools you are putting in your toolbox to do that, whether or not there's some standard form that would accompany a contract, for example, that indicated that the consumer had been warned about the presence or lack thereof of certain things, it had knowledge of the CCB number. I'm just making this up on the fly right now. But I know that when people buy major pieces of equipment, there's disclaimer after disclaimer after disclaimer. And if there was any possibility to make people think before they signed any contract, is there that attachment that indicates that all of the CCB hurdles have been met? And you don't have to answer because I'm just sort of thinking up things on the fly. But the consumer education piece is so important as even a small prophylactic against getting scammed or taken advantage of, particularly older people.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, thank you for your comment. And actually, in my next slide, I have more to say about our outreach. But there are, in the law now, there are certain notices contractors have to provide. But I agree with you totally. I think that the public outreach piece of what we do is so key. And so we're doing everything we can to ramp that up.
One last thing, Mr. Chair.
I don't know whether or not the legislature can give CCB longer fangs to go after miscreants. And I would welcome if you had any suggestions about how we can make your enforcement more powerful. I would welcome, as a member of the committee, hearing that.
Co-chair Senator Johnson, as time goes on and I get more knowledge about what we do and kind of the pitfalls and the impediments to having meaningful enforcement, I will
public
certainly
public floggings. I mean, whatever you think are appropriate.
That's the first time I've heard that come up in a legislature. We do have children in the audience, Senator.
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, if you will permit me to digress just a little bit. I used to be the director of the Architect Examiners Board here in Oregon. And as part of their national organization, which has been around since 1919, has done a lot of work to standardize requirements from state to state. Guam is also a member of that organization. And in Guam, if there is an enforcement action against a miscreant, to use your word, they have a public shaming. I don't really know what that entails.
It sounds like Christmas at the
They have to. The miscreant has to go into some kind of public forum and basically do obeisance for their crime.
We can talk offline, but I feel really legislation moving. Anyway, thank you. The point I was trying to make, Mr. Chair, was what a refreshing change this is. This is as though the agency has had a renaissance, and I think a lot of us are counting on you to be the new sheriff in Dodge and are wishing you the absolute best.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Just a really quick, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a really quick reinforcement of Senator Johnson's point. It wasn't until I started serving on this, as co-chair of this committee in 2013, that I finally knew what the initial CCB stood for, like when you hear a CCB number in an ad. No clue what that was until I started serving on this committee. So that may have been my willful ignorance or lack of personal education, although I've done more than my fair share of remodel projects. A few PSAs about just the way the insurance division is doing now. You drive up north up 12th Street now, and you see a sign that says, they say my car is totaled, I disagree, and tells you to call the insurance division. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a really good use of the insurance division's money, because that means they're doing their job. And I like Senator Johnson, would encourage you to think about ways to engage the public a little bit more so they take advantage of the services you all provide. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let's just
got one
move.
More question, Representative Hurd.
Yes.
So we talked about this some in my office, Mr. Director. The CCBs, it covers for 2 years. The renewal fee is $325. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, how have you been able to keep that so low? I mean, that's a positive thing, because I'm a member of a different industry. For that same time period, it cost me $710. to be licensed. So why are is the CCB, how are you able to keep that low?
Co-chairs, Representative Hurd, will you come with me next time I have to ask for a fee increase?
Well, I mean, it's really more about the other agency that's so high. I'm kind of curious why they're so high and you're, because they're pretty close as far as the two industries. I'm not going to say who it is right now.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about. I can't really speak to that except to say that our fees have increased pretty steadily, biennium to biennium. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. There are other agencies like the Architect Board that I mentioned whose fees are actually lower than CCB's. So there are ways to do it. I think you just have to, you have to be strategic. You have to be determined to keep fees down and do everything that you can as an agency to function efficiently rather than just appeal to a fee increase every time you have financial trouble.
Agreed.
So let's just go to outreach since we're kind of on that subject.
We got one more question. We're going to get you there.
Yes.
Well, Senator Whitson.
Back on the strategic enforcement, it seems to me that the CCB should be able to work with revenue, and they should be able to work with employment, and they should be able to work with BOLI to, instead of, you know, reinventing the wheel on these things, certainly the revenue should be able to alert your investigators when the, for instance, the gross sales of a company doesn't match the typical employment level. Employment should be able to do the same thing for you, actually, to, you know, how, you know, you could check and find out how many people are employed in that company. And then, you know, Boldy could do something useful and actually do some investigation for you under request situations. I mean, it seems to me that there's a way to work together to alter the common purpose of making certain that people follow the rules and pay their taxes and pay their employees and, you know.
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I believe I am remiss in that I passed over enforcement a little too glibly there. But what I had intended to say was that we are, in fact, working together with other agencies on enforcement. And one of the things that we're doing is we're involved in the Intercompliance Network, which is a group that was established by legislation, I think it was in 2009. Representative Holvey knows quite a lot about that. And what we do is our agency, along with Employment Department, Revenue, Workers' Comp, and several others, our investigators get together and they share enforcement case information between them so that if we're finding someone who's working as a so-called exempt contractor, not supposed to have employees, but we find employees on the job site and we cite them for that. Workers' comp and employment can also use that information to do their own enforcement action. So there is a sort of growing cooperation there between the agencies on that sort of thing. And BOLI's also involved in that.
Thank you.
So outreach. I feel, as Senator Johnson expressed, that this is a really critical part of what we do at CCB, and it has always been a part of our work, but my intention is to ramp this up considerably. Our staff are trying to get to every home show and senior fair and special event that we possibly can to reach people. You'll see on my slide, I call this demand side enforcement. That's just my little term I coined, because in every kind of illegal activity, you have a supply and a demand. So in contracting, the supply is the unlicensed contractors out there, and our enforcement people go out and try to nail them. But on the demand side, you have homeowners that will hire a unlicensed contractor, either through ignorance or just because they're the lowest bid. My belief is that an informed public is less likely to hire an unlicensed person. So we're working really hard to get out there. In fact, one of the key performance measures that we are graded on is public awareness of the CCB and the requirements, and I believe we hit 46% this past biennium. In my view, that number should be a lot higher, and it's our goal to make it a lot higher. Just to give you one example of the kind of thing we're doing, we were asked by the city of Tigard to come up and do a presentation on hiring a good contractor. So we got together with the Building Codes Division and at the Tigard Library. One of our board members, a very experienced, knowledgeable contractor, gave a presentation on how to hire a reputable contractor, what to look for, how to work with the contractor, and then the Building Codes Division was there to talk about the building permit requirements and the building department's role. So we just want to do a whole lot more of that moving forward. Make it easier to do business with the CCB. This is a kind of a passion of mine in state government. I've worked in three other state agencies, and I'm always interested in trying to find ways to streamline our administrative operations, and particularly at CCB, anything that we can do to reduce our costs and our time and energy on administrative stuff is more time that we can spend out in the field doing enforcement. So we're looking to streamline and eliminate any outmoded business processes, simplify the rules and regulations, make them easier to understand. Our board has told us that they want us to take a much more deliberate and inclusive approach to rulemaking, so that we know that rules make sense and that they're solving a real problem before we proceed with them. This next point, move to a technology infrastructure that improves online services and efficiency, is something that I have to talk about for a little bit. When I first came to the CCB, I really didn't know how bad the technology infrastructure was, but I had a couple of red flags early on. One was that we had wanted to implement online applications. You can renew a license online, although it could be a lot simpler and more user-friendly. You can do it, but we wanted people to be able to apply for a license online as well. Should be a very simple thing to do. And got our IT staff working on it and really just hit a dead end, found out that we just absolutely could not make it work. Also, adding any additional category of licensure is very challenging for us. So this session, if restoration contractors is something that becomes part of our responsibility, we'll get it done, but it's going to be very difficult to do from an IT standpoint. And in fact, they were gracious enough to amend the bill to delay the implementation to give me time to fix our IT situation first. So that was one red flag. The other was we have a document management system that we use that is for scanning and storing and retrieving documents. It's less than optimal. Nobody there likes it very much. And when I first got there, I was told we need to upgrade to the new version and was handed an invoice for $160,000. And I just kind of said, time out. Before we move forward on any of this, we need to find out what our business needs are for IT, what the current state of our IT infrastructure is, and get some recommendations from someone who knows what they're talking about how to move forward. So we hired a contractor to examine our business and evaluate our IT infrastructure and give us some recommendations, a roadmap on how to move forward. What they found was a multitude of isolated custom-built applications that don't work well together and require development staff to maintain them and extend them. They found predominantly manual business processes resulting from this poor IT support. They found high security, data integrity, and compliance risks associated with the outmoded IT infrastructure. So the strategy that they recommended was that by moving forward and modernizing this whole infrastructure, unifying the software architecture, consolidating the data in one place to create a single view of the licensee, operationalizing our IT costs by adapting a cloud architecture and deploying a common line of business platform. So we've, like I say, we try to make improvements in our business processes, and we have made some that have marginally made us more efficient. But in order to fully capitalize on any sort of business process reengineering, we need a cohesive and a consistent technology platform from which to operate. So the consultant's recommendation and the strategy we intend to pursue over the next biennium is to replace the internally hosted systems and make use of standardized platforms that can be customized to address our business needs, and platforms that have a predictable support cycle and upgrade path. So all of these things will help in making it easier to do business with us online, but there's another benefit.
Representative Nathanson has a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you don't mind a question as an interruption.
No, this is
now.
Perfect.
All right.
I'm very interested to hear what was discovered and acknowledged about the challenges with modernizing and improving technology in another Ways and Means Subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Information Technology. We're hearing overviews from major agencies right now. I'm kind of curious to know what kind of discussions may have transpired about the relationship that this system ought to have with anything available through the Corporations Division in the Secretary of State's office, which of course has a relationship with all businesses in the state. And are we able to capitalize on information that's already there? Or is there any cross-checking?
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, we reached out to the Secretary of State's office. I was just about to say that on our document management system, we are in the process right now as we speak of transitioning to the Oregon Records Management solution that they developed. And so we're going to completely get out of this document management system that we have and use theirs. Mm-hmm. We're also going to be talking with, we've already had some discussions with the Building Codes Division about the possibility of deploying a system together to share all that licensing data.
This is really important.
And you may have heard of House Bill 2843, which is a bill that would allow building codes and CCB to share resources more seamlessly. And so that's kind of one of the things that we're looking to do in this technology overhaul for CCB, is the possibility of sharing resources with, at least with that agency.
Follow up,
please.
So records management or document management, that's the archives division.
It is.
I'm talking about the corporations division. Managing old records, old information, that was a snapshot in time. Managing something from the past is different than live interactive communication with a live system that has relationships with businesses throughout the year and every year. Has there been discussion with the Corporations Division on it? Is there something that should be developed, if it doesn't already exist, so that those systems can talk to each other? And is there any information that is the same that we're repeating in two places?
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, we've had initial conversations with the Corporations Division about their licensing project as well. We are at the very beginning stages of all this, so I'm sure that we'll be talking with them more about that as we move ahead.
I'm pleased to hear that. I encourage the conversation to continue. Thank you.
Okay, so we have about 10 more minutes.
Okay. I'm going to race because I want to give our
Perfect.
Chair an opportunity to speak too. So I'm going to kind of gloss over these slides. If you have a question, just feel free to jump in. Our strategy is to live within our means, to find ways to streamline and operate more efficiently. We're not asking for fee increases in 2017. I call 2017 the biennium when we get our house in order. A exciting piece of news for CCB is that we are moving to a new headquarters this summer. We've had many complaints for many years about access to our offices and about parking. This new headquarters that we're moving to will solve all of those issues and more for us and save us rent at the same time. Finally, I just want to say that, you know, I encourage our staff. We have a brand new management team. I'm new, but the rest of the management team is as well. We consolidated sections. We got rid of several management positions. We got rid of some silos. We have a really energized team that supports one another, and I just encourage all of them to think innovatively about what we do. Don't be bound by the way we've done it in the past. Think entrepreneurially, look to position ourselves for the future, and ultimately, we want to be a model of public service. My hope is that a few years from now, people are looking at the CCB going, that's the model of how you want to do it in state government. And then I just have a slide to show you our management team, where I'm just really proud of all these folks and the work they're doing. And we've created ways to get in touch with us on all sorts of subjects. So be happy to take any other questions that you have or turn it over to our board chair.
Perfect. Any questions for Jim? Yeah, Sandra.
I just have one question, Mr. Dow. Does CCB purchase your service government charges, your service, you know, those services from DAS or from some other agency?
Co-chairs, Senator Witz, it depends on the service. Some things we are getting through DAS. Some things we are not. The habit of our agency, which is kind of in transition now, where IT is concerned, for example, is to do it all in-house. We're not going to continue to do things that way. We do get payroll services through DAS with mixed results, and we get our move is being coordinated by DAS. We're contracting with them to do that. So it depends. Some things we contract with DAS for, yes.
Okay. I wonder if we could ask the staff to get us a printout of the service charges charged to the CCB by, you know, in 11, 13, 15, 17, and the projected ones for 17, 19, and that's going to be a standing request of mine.
Perfect. Would that be all right? Yep. Perfect, Sandra. Any other questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. My name is Kimberly Wood. I am the Director of Corporate Risk Management for Perlo Construction, and I'm also the Chair of the Construction Contractors Board. It's my privilege to come speak with you this afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to do so. The board is thrilled with the way that the CCB is going these days. We are absolutely thrilled with Mr. Deno's performance. He's taken the helm, and we're going in the right direction. The board's comprised of members, much like myself, were active in the construction industry. And so I think that allows us to be actively involved in and keenly aware of the impacts of the legislation and the rulemaking that occurs in our industry. It gives us the ability to help guide the staff so that we find workable solutions to the industry's issues. As a policy board, we wanted to make sure that we're driving meaningful and valuable rules. So we set up some rigorous standards for rulemaking. We've asked the staff to make sure that the rules that they're making are clear, concise, and understandable, that they vet out unintended consequences, and that they're also partnering with our stakeholders. So we know that everybody's had a look at what's going before it even gets out to the rulemaking agenda.
Madam Chair, if I could ask you, when you say partnering with our stakeholders, could you give us an example? Because it is your stakeholders that are part of your problem. In days past, they hate you. And I'm trying to figure out how, what you're doing to empower them, to make them feel as though their voices are being heard, their complaints are being acknowledged. Give me an example.
Sure. Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, we had some rulemaking recently that had to do with the contractors who are on site who don't have have employees that aren't necessarily allowed to have employees. So there could be that there's unreported wages. And so there was some rulemaking that came to the board, and what we realized was we really hadn't vetted that out well. We hadn't talked to our stakeholders before it got to that point. And so we slowed down as a board. We said, listen, we'd like you to go back to the stakeholders. We'd like you to reach out to AGC. We'd like you to reach out to Home Builders Association and some of our other stakeholders and talk to them about how this would actually impact the industry. And work it through and then come back to us and let's talk about whether or not this is a good way to move forward. One of the directives that we've given in the past, it appeared that the way that it ran was the staff would create a rule and they'd bring it to the board and we'd be all the way in the middle of rulemaking and realize nobody really talked to our stakeholders. Well, as a stakeholder, as well as a board member, I don't like that. I want to know about it before we get to the rulemaking process. We should be having discussions way before that. So we've slowed down that process. They're reaching out to stakeholders at all the time now. So I know that AGC is more involved. I believe the Home Builders Association is also more involved and some of the other stakeholders. So I think we're trying to address that issue.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt.
To follow up on Senator Johnson's line of questioning, within the rulemaking process, there are kind of three levels. One of them is a comment period for the public. One of them is a public hearing. And the third and most rigorous, of course, is the Rules Advisory Committee. So what is your plan to expand into that hearings, public hearings and Rules Advisory Committee levels?
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, I don't know that we've thought in that process. What we were trying to do was slow it down before it even got into that process and have stakeholders take part in that at that point before we ever got to the actual rules. We're talking with them to get that fleshed out in advance and then working with them as we draft those rules. So I don't know that we've thought about it formally in that regard, but I think probably we should.
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things that I've been amazed with, I used to work in state government once upon a time myself. The employees at CCB are fantastic. They love their job. We see comments coming in all the time, complimenting particular individuals that are in the agency. So I just wanted to bring it to your attention. These employees love what they do. They're dedicated, they're energized, and they are on board. The board itself decided we needed to be more involved with the staff. We needed to know them. They needed to know us. So we've taken steps. We meet with them. I stop in at the office, not unexpectedly, but regularly. And so do the other board members. So we've really made an effort to make them. So it's a team effort, not just two separate entities that are kind of working together. I think that's helping, and I think they are looking forward to renewing our focus on being a transparent agency, reaching out to our stakeholders, educating the public and our contractors, and partnering with other agencies, and lastly, enforcing the laws and the rules that we have in place. So I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, appreciate it.
Representative Hurd, then we'll go to Senator Johnson.
Question for the director. It just came to me. There was, involving the customer service aspect of this, you know, serving the people of Oregon, there was a relative of mine back in Douglas County who was doing this big project. It required a specialty contractor any contractor in the state of Oregon at the time. That may have changed by now, but they had to import this contractor essentially from Minnesota to do the work. They did not have, obviously, a CCB license issued by the state of Oregon. The CCB got involved, and if I recall correctly, they basically had to find a loophole my relative did with that Minnesota contractor on which they could actually complete the project. It was not. So how do we deal with that situation? Is that something we need to make a change in the law with by the legislature, or is that something you can do through your rules process, or how do we address that kind of a special circumstance?
Co-chairs, Representative Hurd, I'm not really sure. That's the honest answer to your question. The fact is, to work in Oregon, you have to have a license. So there would have to be some other method of, I know in the architect world, you can bring an architect from another state to work on a project in Oregon, but they have to work under the responsibility and under the license of the Oregon architect. So maybe there's a way forward, something similar to that.
Yeah, I'd be interested in following you and me working on that together, see if we can find a solution
sure.
to that.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. A question for either or both of you. The matter of continuing education has been an area where you've had a particular rub, I think, with the people you regulate. And I'd like to know where on the board's priority list reviewing those protocols is, and or if. If it's not, I would hope that you would consider adding it.
Would you like me to take that?
Sure.
Co-chair, Senator Johnson, we are working on that right now. We're getting stakeholders together to find out what can we do going forward to make this program meaningful without it being onerous. Unfortunately, the way the program was rolled out wasn't particularly effective, and there have been a couple of, I would call them, if not knee-jerk, at least attempts to fix it that haven't gone well either. And so I would like, if going forward, to find out, just get the issues on the table, find out what is it that is going to fix this thing and get something that will work. I have my own ideas about what that might involve, but we need to get everybody around the table. In fact, we have a meeting scheduled, I think it's in April, to meet with folks about that.
A couple of things I'd like to flag. I've gotten numerous constituent complaints about people who have been doing, let's say, earth moving for 40 years. No complaints. That's the only role that they play, and they're being asked to do a continuing ed on envelope structures and things like that. There's no relevance at all.
Right.
Or for those very narrow subspecialties, I had a guy that made wrought iron handle or railings, and is all he did was to apply those to the side of a residence. He eventually went out of business. Whether or not you've given any thought to track records where people have performed with a spotless record and could they be grandfathered, I don't know. It's a very complex issue because we all want consumer protection, but some of the requirements didn't seem to fit the specialties where people were actually plying their trade.
Co-chair, Senator Johnson, that's the exact kind of issue that we need to wrestle with. I don't have an answer for that today, but that's the kind of thing that we're talking about.
If it's on your radar screen, I'm happy.
It is all over my radar screen.
Cool.
All right. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your presentation. We appreciate your public testimony.
Thank you.
So we're going to, in a moment, folks, we're going to be visiting with our friends from the county fairs, but very quickly we're going to go to Dustin with the Department of Administrative Services for his overview.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, Dustin Ball with the Chief Financial Office. In the interest of time, I'll be brief in my comments. My presentation today is intended to provide you with a high-level overview of the governor's budget for the Construction Contractors Board. Let me get this. So in developing the governor's budget for the Construction Contractors Board, we looked at the emergent issues that the agency was facing. That included the revenue concerns. This really started in with the economic downturn in about 2007. Also, we are looking at the efforts the agency has recently been undertaking to improve its agency operations. This is with new leadership and reorganization of its staff structure. We also looked at how the agency interacts with the 10-year plan for Oregon, particularly the economy and jobs outcome area. This next slide is going to give you an overview of the agency's expenditure history over time. The far left is the actual, and you notice it's substantially lower than the 13-15 LAB, and the reason for that is the agency, with the downturn, they were underspending their budget. They were proactively managing the budget so that they could reserve the ending fund balance to be carried forward, and this talks to that ability to keep their fees low. The far right is the governor's budget, proposed budget for 15-17, and we'll talk about the decrease in the expenditure limitation and the FTE. That's really two components. One is a revenue shortfall package, which reduces the expenditures of the agency to maintain operations going forward. And also, there's some savings in there as a result of administrative actions that the agency has taken to reorganize its structure. When we look at the revenues of the agency, we see that about 66% of the revenues are derived from the licensing renewals, and new licensees are about 14%. So the major component of the revenues is really driven by new and renewing licensees. And as this next slide will show, the high was back in about 2007 when the agency was just over 45,000 licensees. And with that downturn in the economy, that dipped to around 34,000.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And this is actually a question for Mr. Deno based on what you're showing us here. You know, you were talking earlier about unlicensed contractors, and it makes me wonder, too, how many of the currently, I mean, I know it's impossible to tell, but how many of the people you identify as unlicensed contractors were in the past licensed, and as they were dealing with the economic downturn, one of the things that they made a choice was to roll the dice, essentially. They wanted to do the right thing, but I mean, it's not that licensure is that expensive in the grand scheme of things, but the continuing education is expensive and, you know, the cost of maintaining all this stuff. So I'm kind of curious if you have any sense, as you get complaints about unlicensed contractors, how many of them were at one point in the past licensed, or if they've all never been licensed. Worth considering.
Madam Chair, that is a great question. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm just dying to find out now that you raise it.
Happy to offer you new opportunities for research, Mr.
Thank you.
Deno.
So the key takeaway in this slide is we believe that we have hit a point where the decline has stopped, that the licensing numbers may have stabilized, and in the upcoming biennium, we may finally start to see some return of licensees to the industry.
If you don't mind, I'll just add to that. December of 13 is when we bottomed out. Numbers have risen very, very slightly since then, but not significantly, maybe 1%.
So the governor's budget for the Construction Contractors Board does include a package. It's a revenue shortfall package, and this reduces expenditures by about $1.25 million and reduces the FTE for the agency, or positions, by 7. And we're projecting an ending balance of the agency between 3 to 4 months of operating expenditures. I'd be happy to address any questions that members may have.
Any questions? Thank you. Okay, folks, we appreciate your time. We're going to move to the public testimony portion of the CCB, and I have one person signed up. Ralph, you're up. Is there anyone else who wanted to sign up but isn't on the list?
He left.
Well,
he was on the list.
Okay, if he comes back in, I'll grab him up.
Yeah, you can grab him.
All right.
I know you're in a hurry, so I'll hurry quick. Ralph Groner with Oregon asked me when it comes to CCC Construction Contractors Board. I've had that for about 30 years. I understand the changes that have been made, and I understand and appreciate all the help of the legislature. I would say this, when I look at this, I am so glad that the bill, I don't know where the bill is yet, to allow CCB and BCD, building codes, to cooperate. I'm not sure we ever really needed that with this wonderful new director and Mark Long, who most of us in this business consider one of the top administrators, by the way, in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I looked at some of the things needed, and I went, my God, Mark's already done the e-permitting, sign up online, everything. He led the nation with the computer stuff, and that's one area where I would hope not only hiring outside folks, but when you have an agency in similar different business, then hopefully you could utilize that since they're both state agencies dealing with contractors and a building. Secondly, I was glad to see the permit coming together. Many of us have wanted to see this for a long time, you know that, and it's beginning to happen. The only thing I recall, and I'll tell you a little story, I had local business people in my county, Clackamas County. See, Ralph, will you come in? And I'm a lobbyist. I'm not a legislator any longer. I think they thought I was a legislator, but I grew about 50 years older. And they said, we got a problem with CCB. I said, what is that problem? Business after business. Well, we aren't getting help when we call. And I said, well, let me look into that. It ended up, I looked at the Portland metro area, and they had one investigator. I said, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for, what are we, over a million people? And so then I found out they were under a private contract with the state and that they had all kinds of crises. I know some of you are upset if I attack the private sector, but in this case, it wasn't working. It wasn't working at all. So fortunately, there was a gentleman here in this building sitting right there named Senator Bates at the hearing when this came up. He said, that's it. They fixed it. You all did if you were on that committee. Fixed it, and you have the folks. The problem is if the revenue's down and we have investigators who try to do the job fairly with the contractors. But the problem is if someone gets through and it doesn't found, we can't get them, little things like happened to my house way back when I was a kid. Long before I ran, I had someone come and remodel my little house, and they didn't put the flashing on the, I didn't know enough about this. Water creeped down through my walls, and next thing I know, I got termites and carpenter ants, and I ended up owing $100,000, and it took me a number of years to pay that off so that I could finally afford a little shack on the other side of Oregon City. So this stuff's important, by the way, not only to this agency, but to you as consumer advocates, you all are. But in fact, it's got to have the tools, updated tools. I used to have a rep, my staff reps, Randy Ritterbush, you say, Ralph, they're using phones from the 18th century over there. And you would have probably said the same thing, Betsy. And I said, you got to be kidding, went over a building codes.
Point of personal privilege. Yes. Was that a reference to my age, Mr. Greger?
The reference to your beauty. Thank you, Senator. All right, that's enough. I said too much. Thank you for allowing me to support this budget. These people, they are my members, but more importantly, they're members of all of yours who try to do a tough job and get it done with the resources a little bit slim, as you can see now. So whatever you could do to help with the resources would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. We appreciate your testimony. All righty. We're going to close the public testimony portion of our public hearing on House Bill 5011. Any opposition to that out there? Anyone wanted to speak? All right. We're closed. We're now going to open up an informational hearing related to county fairs. How do we want to proceed forward? Do we have a list of folks who would like to speak? How do you want to do this? Come on up. Come on up. We can accommodate three at a time. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for being patient as we work through the Construction Contractors Board.
Thank you. Co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, thank you. And Smith, subcommittee members, my name is Kelly Ross, and I serve as Executive Secretary of the Oregon Fairs Association. We thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you today. I have with me today Don Sloan, who is the current president of the Oregon Fairs Association, and Brenda Mayberry. Brenda is from the Douglas County Fair, and Don is from the Harney County Fair. And I would turn it over to Don at this point.
Co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, and Smith, and the rest of the subcommittee members, thank you very much for allowing Oregon Fairs to have their first ever day at the Capitol in the history of the Oregon Fairs, which is 86 years and running strong. So thank you once again. As Kelly mentioned, my name is Don Sloan. I'm the manager of the Harney County Fair Rodeo and Race Meet over in Burns, Oregon, where I told everyone this morning, I'm sure the sun is shining over there today. And I also happen to be the first ever Oregon representative on the Western Fairs Association Board of Directors based out of Sacramento, California. Oregon Fairs has 37 members. There's 36 county fairs plus the Oregon State Fair. And we also have 133 dues-paying members called service members. Most of those service members are entertainers that we all, every county fair has the opportunity to hire those entertainers to entertain our patrons during the fair. Now, there's a lot of other service members that do various other things to help support the operation of a county fair, such as insurance people, people that sell ribbons and trophies, and on and on. So I'm happy to say that state fairs and fairgrounds continue to be one of the biggest, and perhaps the biggest, gathering spot for Oregonians during the summer and during the off, what we call the off season, which would be the other 51 weeks of the year. Fairgrounds, as you know, are the hub of most of the counties in Oregon, and especially rural Oregon. There's countless events that fill motel rooms, restaurants, buy a lot of gas, and many other things that support the economy of each of those counties. From a public service perspective, it also provides a gathering place for emergency services such as wildfire. Where I come from in Eastern Oregon, people ask me, where are you from? And I say, well, I'm from the part of Oregon that has no earthquakes, tornadoes, or hurricanes. And the sun shines 360 days of the year. Mm-hmm. So, we have the big thing that's in our county fair would be wildfire. You know, we have many fire camps at the fairgrounds. But Cycle Oregon, that's one that you probably all are very familiar with. That they continue to come over to Eastern Oregon and ride the back roads. And so that's a huge event that uses county fairgrounds in Eastern Oregon to camp overnight and to have their relaxation. You know, they have some entertainment and some food and beverage there waiting for them. It also, Red Cross, many public safety trainings and health clinics could be held at a fairground. So, you know, a fairgrounds has the infrastructure. You've already got shower rooms, you have running water, you've got restrooms, you've got probably a good-sized parking area for camping tents and so on. So, you know, every county fairgrounds already has that many other facilities in that county does not. I wanted to say that, I'm kind of from Eastern Oregon, a country boy, a little bit of a redneck, I guess, and wanted to say that you probably haven't seen this many people wearing blue jeans in the state capitol in a while, have you?
Haven't been on the floor of the Senate.
So we have about 60 people here today from around Oregon Fair, so we feel that's a very good turnout for our first time doing this event. And then you saw all of the 4-H kids that were here also in support of us, which we support them very much, as well as FFA. So we had a 100-plus strong contingent here today to rally and brag about ourselves to all of you. And speaking of bragging, total fair attendance at the 37 events last year were 1.7 million people. Yeah. And that right there, that's more people than attended 7 home University of Oregon football games and 6 OSU home football games, plus 41 Portland Trail Blazer games. So we, at the county fair level, had more people attending our events than those 3 big-time sporting events. The 15,000 events during what we call the off-season, I mentioned that was the other 51 weeks of the year, 15,000 different events on those county fairgrounds. 3.9 million people attended those 15,000 events. Mm-hmm. And those statistics are four times what the attendance at the Portland International Raceway and the Oregon Convention Center was. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty remarkable. Payrolls, 1,500 full and part-time people work and draw a salary from a Oregon fair for the in the tune of $9 million. And of course, every county fair cannot survive without the tremendous volunteer workforce that we all have. We had over 10,000 people volunteering for those 37 events in 2014, and if you were to take the 233,000 hours that is estimated that those people worked and put that to a minimum wage, just I don't know what that math is, but that's a lot of money that we would be paying to have a county fair if it was not for those volunteers.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
Let me interrupt your testimony for just a second and ask you this. I'm well aware of how important volunteers are. Our Columbia County Fair, all volunteers. Tillamook would die without volunteers. But that brings us to the point of the state fair that struggles between that dynamic of allowing volunteers and having a state-paid workforce there. What are your prognostications for the survivability of the state fair, and what would it do to county fairs were it not to exist as a state fair any longer, or not to exist in Salem as a state fair any longer?
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, that I was hoping to make a comment about that very question, is that for me, and I'm sure all of OFA members would have the same attitude on this, is that the state fair means so much to the county fair, and to put it into a generalization, it would, without a state fair, it would be like a county government without this state capital.
Some people might think that was just a peachy outcome. but I think the point that you're trying to make is that without having sort of the culmination of all of the county fairs building up to the state fair, how about the location in Salem? Could the state fair go someplace else if there were adequate hospitality accommodations, hotel rooms, places to park trailers, all that sort of stuff? I'm thinking like Redmond or...
And again, Co-Chair Senator Johnson, that Redmond would probably be the only location in Oregon that there would be the facility that could possibly handle an Oregon State Fair. You'd have the motel facilities in both Bend and Redmond to house the folks going there. And Redmond, Deschutes County Fair, is the biggest, largest county fair in Oregon, facility-wise and attendance and on and on. So the question that I would have, if it was moved to Redmond, is that it seemed to me like in my years of coming on the west side of Oregon that the only way you can get the western people, they go to Central Oregon plenty to ski, but I don't know if they would go that far to the state fair. So that would be my one question.
Let me just make sure I understand you, that people from Portland would see a drive to Salem as an acceptable drive, but they might not see the drive to Redmond as an acceptable drive.
Yes, that'd be
okay.
My,
thank you.
Yeah.
Please continue.
Thank you. Let's see. Oh, junior livestock auction. You know, the 4-H kids that were here today, you know, we're very proud to say that one of our big accomplishments is the junior livestock auction receipts for 2014 was at $8.4 million mm-hmm. to all those youth around Oregon. And you, all of you know that the principal way that those youth spend that money is to continue their higher education at most of the time at an Oregon university or college. So that's a real a big bragging point for all of us. A big time statistic that I'm always proud of is the fairgrounds facilities are used by many service organizations that do their fundraising projects throughout the year. We had a lot of those groups. 643 nonprofit organizations used the fairgrounds during the fair or in the off season. And that generated another $9 million for all of their community support projects. That's remarkable. I know at the Harney County Fair, I've said for years that the between the service members or the service organizations and the junior livestock auction, they make twice as much money as the fair board does. But we're all right with that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're plenty all right with that because we know that that is helping to support our kids and our local economy. Well, we could go on and on about statistics and bragging points. I hope you all got a chance to be in the gallery today that Kelly had put together a number of big-time statistics from there, some of which I've mentioned here already. But getting on to House Bill 5029 and Senate Bill 5502, you know, we're very appreciative of the state legislature for giving us the funding that we've received in all the years in the past, and especially here the last few years. Here again, I'm going
point
to
point out, though, I want the committee to know that this level, while it's tweaked up and down, is effectively the same level for the last at least eight terms. And so I don't think you folks have seen an increase in a long, long time.
Well, we voluntarily took a cut, I'm going to say 5 or 6 years ago, a 15% cut that lowered our yearly amount to $36,000. Yeah. And now we're up to, you know, an all-time high. I think 2 years ago we were at an all-time high. It was $3 or something short of $51,000, so just slightly better than this year. But one comparison that I make, and I wish I had the statistics for the entire state, but for Harney County, when you add up all the 4-H youth that turn in a record book, plus the FFA kids that participate at the fair, we're at somewhere in the neighborhood of 220 to 230 youth. So one of the things I use in my marketing and talking at public organizations, I always say that we are teaching those kids a lifelong skill, and more than one skill. You know, they're in the they're showing animals at the fair, so they're learning how to breed those animals, how to feed them, how to groom them, you know, how all the things that it takes in order to put the very best, finest animal together that they can to bring the top dollar at the auction. But they're also in the in-house exhibits. They're doing leathercraft. They're making jam and jelly. A lot of those in-house things they're learning, the school system does not teach anymore.
Senator Whitsitt, and then to Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and a question. Comment about our priorities. We gave a corollary parallel organization to the Energy Trust of Oregon $10 million in lottery bonds in the last two sessions, and we have no accountability on how it's spent. And over the last eight sessions, we haven't increased the fares allocate at all. The question is on your last line in the other fundings, sponsorships, lodging taxes, and so forth. You're down about $1 million over the last couple of years. Is that sponsorships, or is that reduction in transient lodging taxes, or is that counties starting to take that transient lodging taxes from you, or what?
I'm very uncertain the answer to that.
That's a good question. That would be something we could research and come back to you on.
Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
A lot of us don't receive the transit. A lot of because we're counting just state.
In a minute, we're going to ask you to come up and share with us. Senator Johnson.
I just think it should be important and on the record, particularly for our new folks, that when county fairs took that cut, that was not imposed upon them by the legislature. That was the county fairs coming in and saying, we know that you've got a budget problem and we want to offer up our share. That's unique in this building, too. I mean, you could walk down the hall and 9 in 10 people are seeking money. And the county fairs took the leadership position of coming in and offering money up. I think good behavior ought to be rewarded if the committee thinks that maybe there ought to be an increase. And I think it's important to have the whole committee understand that that was voluntary on their part.
Yeah, co-chair Senator Johnson, that I happened to be the president of the Oregon Fairs at that time in 7 and 8 when that happened. And we had a teleconference and everyone voted. It was a unanimous decision to take that cut, which I think was a 15% cut at the time, and thinking that, you know, that's people like Senator Johnson are going to remember that, and it's going to pay dividends at a later time.
She did, and I hope so.
Wise move. All right. Anything else you want to share with us?
Oh, we could share a lot, I'm sure, but, you know, we've covered the main things that I think we have, haven't we, Brenda and Kelly?
Brenda, is there anything you wanted to share with us?
Well, and one thing about the lodging tax and so forth, that is something that is county by county. I know in Douglas County, we don't receive any lodging tax there. It's something that goes all to the city. And so it's something that we have discussed and looked at proposing in our own county to see if we couldn't find some other support. But it's not something that is the same across the state in each county. It is different.
Perfect. Just very quickly, could you identify yourself so we have it for the record?
Brenda Mayberry, Douglas County Fair and OFA Vice President.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. Any other questions or comments for these folks? Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to come up and share a few thoughts? Dan, come on up.
No.
Come on, don't be bashful. Anyone else want to join Dan?
Nobody yeah. wants to join Dan.
Come on up.
Dan, I'll give you moral support.
All right.
There are three chairs.
There's three chairs. We have one more chair. Yeah, come on up. Perfect. Perfect. Again, just identify yourself for the record. And
Dan Dorn, New Matilla County Fair, and live in Hermiston, Oregon. And to address, first of all, thank you, co-chairs, Representative Smith and Senator Steiner Hayward, and the full committee. And first of all, thank you for all of the support from this building over the years for the Oregon County Fairs. One of the answers, quickly, for Senator Whitsett's question is the fairs are very, very dependent on weather. We can be millions of dollars off in revenue in 1 year if a storm rolls through two fairs at the same time. Last year, Umatilla County Fair, it was 110 degrees for 4 days in a row. We were down almost $250,000. So there's a quarter of your $1 million right there as far as revenue goes. In the same time, if it's 85 degrees every day, we will be up $700,000. The only true solid funding we all get, even at the county level, we fight individually with our counties for support, and that's all across 36 boards of how that happens. But the only funding that we count as a foundation is the money that comes from this committee and from the state legislatures out of the lottery funds. The one thing that I wanted to come up and talk about that Don taught just briefly about is really the youth of these county fairs. 43 years ago, when I took my steers to the Umatilla County Fair, the face was a whole lot different. The problem is the perception around the state, if you're not going to county fairs, is that's what a county fair is today, the same as it was 43 years ago when I took my steer. That's not the case. We talk about this being a diverse state. If you go to the Umatilla County Fair, that's where diversity begins. The stripes and different colors of each and every participant is incredible. And they mingle. That is where they melt together, is the county fairs. If you invite all of the new people, the immigrants, the transfers, the people that are moving to your areas, that's where they blend. You can have community centers, you can have schools. Those are places where they segregate themselves naturally. A county fair is a natural, diverse mixture because everybody has to participate together. The support falls off instantly if you start working against each other. A fair just falls apart. And that's not the wish of anybody in any community. If you truly want to see how a community develops diversity, youth, maturity, go to a county fair. And if you haven't been to a county fair lately, you need to, because it's not the same as it was 43 years ago when I walk my steer a mile and put it in a barn. And that's a fact. And I do thank all of you for the time to listen to us. And truly, if you haven't been to a county fair, please go. Any one of the 36 in this state, you will be proud that you supported it. Thank you all.
I think you did wonderful.
One thing, for the record, my name is Alan Westhoff. I manage the Amhill County Fair in McMinnville. In my previous job, I was manager of the county fair in Southern Oregon, and we went out after a levee at one time to support extension and so on and so forth. And we had had a big meeting in our fairgrounds, and we had 400 or 500 people there, and the district attorney or county attorney, one of the law-abiding guys, he said, can I make a speech? Can I talk? And I thought, oh, boy, right out of the courthouse, here we go. He talked 3 minutes. He said, I want you to know I've been here 9 years. I've never had a 4-H or FFA kid in my office. Right. Never. And that's powerful, people, powerful. And one other thing, that we in the fair business give away a lot of scholarships. Scholarships, and it was not aforementioned. And I think for right alone in 4-H and fairs and fairgrounds and fair boards and whatever, I don't know what the total is, but it's unbelievable the amount of scholarships that we give away. Thanks again for your support.
Thank you very much.
I'll address. Bob Wolf, Umatilla County Fair, Hermiston, Oregon. My point to you is the youth that are there. And you, Dan and Alan have both touched on it, and that's where it's really at. It's in the youth that show up there. It goes beyond the money. It transcends the money. Those are the people that become productive members of society later on. We can either encourage them in the right fashion to do well, or we can take another approach later on down the road. And those kids that come through there, we watch them come through. I was there 25 years ago. My kids have completed that now. This is my daughter. This will be her senior year there. And those kids go on, and they do extremely well in our communities. And that's where it's at. It's far beyond the dollars.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
If I could just comment, I've said on many radio shows and in town halls, in urging people to come to the fairs in my district, it's not the 4-H kids or the FFA kids that are knocking over your mailbox. And we spend so much money cleaning up after kids that make bad decisions. Why not invest on the front end on kids that are making great decisions?
Yes, second that.
We've heard that message, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Yes, we have.
Thank you, gentlemen. And committee, I want to brag just very quickly and let you know that Bob and Dan are they're the bread and butter of Umatilla County. And so we're so glad you folks are here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we still have about 6-7 minutes. Is there anyone else who wants to share some thoughts? This is our chance. All right. Has it all been said? We're good. Committee, is there any questions or thoughts you have? All right, we ran an efficient committee today. We're going to adjourn 7 minutes early. Is there anything we need to be thinking about? Are we good?
We're good. Tomorrow we're going to hear from the Board of Tax Practitioners, and that's the only agency we have on the agenda.
Perfect. Julie, are we good? All right.
Mr. Chair, before you bang the gavel, let me just ask. Let's assume that good fortune smiles on county fairs and there is some additional money somewhere in this committee's budget. How would they divide it? Would it be pro rata, or what would be the methodology for distribution to make sure that there was a degree of equity?
That's perfect. Who would like to address that? You want to come up, Mr. Chair, and talk about that issue so the committee's clear?
Wouldn't they just play poker?
We'd like to do it with horse races.
We don't want to play poker with Harney County.
Well, for those of you that are longtime members of here at the Capitol, like Mr. Smith and Betsy Johnson, you remember back in the old merit rating days. And in those days, you know, we had a workbook that we had independent people come that were all very experienced through the years in county fairs. And so those individuals came to all the county fairs and went through that workbook and gave you X number of points by how well you did in that that topic of discussion. So every fair in them days got a different amount of money. Barbara Roberts, when she was governor of Oregon, she did away with that system because the amount of money that was given from the highest scoring fair to the lowest scoring fair was not a lot of dollar difference. And so she thought that it made no sense whatsoever to spend money on this accountability system to grade your fairs when there wasn't a lot of difference in the amount of money going to each fair. So she said, let's do away with that. Let's give them all the same amount of money. Well, at that particular time, we, as a group, were not much in favor of that because we all realized that that system had built better fairs. You know, we were all able to make improvements in the areas where we didn't score so high. And so we kind of didn't like that decision. But I think now that we've turned and no one can say I got more than you, I got a gold medal, you got a silver, you know, anything like that that was awarded during them times. And so we all anxiously await. You know, the statute says the first Monday of January those checks will be cut, and we got ours on February something this year. So I think, you know, that if we took a vote of the people right here in the room right now, that it'd be unanimous that we'd just share it even, Stephen.
Just equally divided among the counties.
Yeah.
Senator Johnson.
If I could comment for the benefit of our new members, some time ago, some strictures were put in place that fairs had to attain certain minimum qualifications on animal management, sanitation, waste disposal, the things that had to do with consumer safety, visitor safety. And to the best, and they all report back to the County Fairs Association. To the best of my knowledge, that reporting system has been going well, has it not?
It has been very well. We have a committee that is, the title of that committee is the Reports and Information Committee that reviews that report form on an annual basis and makes improvements to it. And so that's the form and the report right there that all the statistics that we gave you today came from that report. So it's our kind of our own internal accountability system.
Perfect, perfect. All righty. Thank you very much, committee members. Thank you. We're so glad you folks came, and we hope your time at the Capitol was good, and we hope it continues to be great throughout the day. All right. Julie, I'm going to close us down here. Seeing no other business before us, we're going to close the informational hearing, and we're going to adjourn for the day.
I was just looking at her.
And we're going to adjourn for the day.
I was just looking at her.